Okay, you can proceed. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. The DOC is the third largest department in state government. It employs over 4,300 people, many of whom may be watching today. The department manages 11 complex prison facilities, funds the supervision of nearly 88,000 people across the state, and incarcerates nearly 8,000 individuals. For your reference, here is a map of the 11 facilities representing a footprint of over 75 million square feet of facility space across the state. The work of the DOC is not siloed, and as we address the needs and risks of individuals incarcerated in Minnesota, it is important to recognize that the policy and investments we request are not focused simply on the probation and prison administration. Because rehabilitation requires a focus on all aspects of a person's lives, in many areas of the governor's budget recommendation, you'll see interagency efforts. That is particularly true in corrections. Because we want to produce the best outcomes related to public safety, we have robust and transformative interagency proposals in the areas of housing stability, addiction recovery and successful reentry, employment navigation and support, along with secondary and higher education investments. Due to the size and detail of the request before you, we would ask that you review the full governor's recommendation for corrections and the fact sheets, many of the proposals. The fact sheets are in your packets and also linked on various slides in the presentation. Members, there's a lot to say about the challenges facing the Department of Corrections, and I need to put this in context. In the past few days, make that picture even more compelling. The Department of Corrections operates and is staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Work in corrections is among the most challenging work across the state enterprise, and the work is not without risk. Just this week, several staff at both the Oak Park Heights and Stillwater prisons were assaulted. Staff suffered broken facial bones, concussions, black eyes, cuts, and scrapes. I want to be direct here. We must do better by our staff. Investments in our correction system have lagged behind other public safety sectors. As prison admission once again spike, maintaining competitive pay is essential. It's essential for our staff, essential for their families, and it is importantly essential to the state's safety and the people we serve. Like many public safety sectors, the DOC is facing a staffing crisis, requiring forced overtime just to keep the facilities running and secure. Far too often, our staff report for a shift, not knowing if they're going to work an 8-hour day or a 16-hour day. The Department of Corrections is 97% funded by the state's general fund. It is almost entirely dependent upon the legislature on you for adequate funding. For investments to improve working conditions, the physical environment, compensation, and evidence-based practices and programs that will produce better public safety outcomes for our state. The DOC has some of the most archaic and antiquated technology and data systems in the state, yet we are expected and should be tracking outcomes that directly relate to safety and well-being of our staff and the people we serve, and the public safety outcomes for our community. It is the nature of human beings that out of sight often means out of mind. In the case of those committed to our state prisons, I literally mean out of sight. Behind those massive brick walls or massive front fencing structures topped with razor wire, the people who live in them and work in them are often hidden. In the most basic sense, our prisons are the failures of our society, unaddressed traumas, impossible challenges for our government. Whether it be the failures of education or child welfare, mental health access, economic opportunity disparity, or racist systems, our correction system is left to address these challenges and expected to produce better outcomes, oftentimes with insufficient resources. Don't get me wrong. People need to be held to account for violations of laws and the harm done to other people. We know this. Staff do this work in service to our state and the people committed to our prisons must daily walk into or live in the buildings that have tens of millions of dollars in unaddressed maintenance needs. But in them, staff provide and residents receive health care, education, work opportunity, chemical dependency treatment, mental health services, and a host of other programming at a time when there is rightful concern about community safety. Now is the time to invest in a system that must include effective law enforcement, properly resourced prosecution, defense, judicial services, but we cannot forget what happens behind those walls and those fences. Madam Chair and members, we have been at this precipice before as it relates to prison population. The choice becomes clear. Build a new prison, a $1 billion proposition in construction costs alone, not to mention the $50 million plus to operate on an annual basis. Or make significant investments. The governor and lieutenant governor's proposed budget for corrections is, as I said, considerable. But it is grounded in the belief that we can make a difference, a recognition of the fact that accountability and rehabilitation are not distinct political ideologies. They are, in fact, two sides of the same coin. So let me talk about the opportunities reflected in this budget. We have an enormous opportunity. This committee is tasked with funding the systems of government that support our state's public safety, law enforcement, criminal investigations, corrections, and victim support services. You've heard me say it before, 95% of those who are in our prisons will return to their communities. As a state, we have to, simply must, prepare them in the most effective way to, if we want to reduce victimization and criminal activity. Effective intervention also reduces the likelihood of generational system involvement. Members, we're at a crucial time and a critical time in our history of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. We can pave a new, evidence-based, data-driven path forward for a safer Minnesota, or we can maintain the status quo. In line with the DOC's mission, the governor has recommended a transformative budget, investments in public safety, facility security, support of our staff, all focused on a more rehabilitative correction system that will serve our state for decades to come. So let's get into it. Turning to the most significant of our requests, the governor is recommending $44 million in the next biennium to maintain the DOC's current level of service delivery, and $10 million to account for the basic need forecasted in the rise of the state's prison population. These funds will maintain our current staffing complement and baseline operations of the department. Again, we recognize the significance of the amount requested. However, it is foundational to our operations of the agency. Context around the request is important. First, there was no supplemental budget last session, something the DOC has historically relied upon to relieve budget pressures based on its compensation-heavy budget and the shifting cost of managing such a large operation. We've all seen and experienced the impact of inflation on our basic needs, of which the DOC provides in large scale. Food costs, utility costs, and supplies have all impacted our costs and operations. Very importantly, due to the impact of COVID-19 pandemic in reducing the state's prison population, the DOC took a significant budget cut in 2021. The cut eliminated programs and services across the agency that must see reinvestment to accommodate the now rising population from the COVID backlog. Please be aware that there is a shift in how the legislature must now consider the cost of increased incarceration. In previous biennia, the forecasted cost of incarceration was built into the base budget, similar to the education formula. That changed recently, where policymakers must now proactively consider these costs and appropriate funding as a budget request. The cost in this budget category, if not funded, will create a budget deficit for the agency. Members, as you can see here, as the court processes through the backlog of criminal cases through the pandemic, our prison population will rise significantly, back to levels seen 4 or 5 years ago. The current capacity of the DOC will be exceeded in as few as 2 years. The request before you includes per diem costs to reflect that projection. This number reflects a single bunking at Stillwater as recommended by the OLA in their 2020 report on prison safety. Note that the Rush City facility remains double bunked despite the fact that it was built as a single bunking facility. And the women's facility in Shakopee was built to house just over 300, but currently, as of today, incarcerates 546. Without investments in rehabilitation and reducing recidivism, we will reach our capacity, leading to that less effective and much more costly solution of a new prison. Again, a $1 billion proposition. We've covered this, much of this, but is it also important to consider the constitutional obligation of the state to provide health care and a standard of living for those who are incarcerated under state law? Moving on to the budget needs within the facilities, we'll start with the tools and systems to help recruit and retain our staff. Members, on many of these slides, I encourage you to read the attached fact sheets provided in your packets and linked to the slides. Here you'll see a number of investments requested to support the dedicated staff of the department, from professional development to staff wellness and support. And I just highlight our hiring efforts. In calendar year 2021, the DOC hired 245 corrections officers and retained just 136, or 44%. In calendar year 2022, we hired 620 corrections officers and we retained 357, or 58%. It's notable that the number of DOCs, authorized strength for the DOC's corrections officer, is just shy of 2,100. Moving on to the budget request for health services. It probably goes without saying, but we don't get to choose who is sentenced to prison. Regardless of whether that person has cancer, HIV, or hepatitis C, we are constitutionally mandated and morally obligated to provide safe, timely, and high-quality medical care to everyone. About 8% of our population is considered severely mentally ill, and 4% are insulin-dependent, 4 times the rate of people outside of prison. 80 to 100 people are treated annually for hepatitis C, and at any given time, we treat about 160 individuals who are HIV positive, requiring monthly medications. Our patients are very high need, very often admitted to the DOC with comorbidities. This is true not just for physical ailments, but for behavioral health conditions as well. Often they have not had access to primary care in the community, and their in-prison intake physical may be, in some cases, the first physical they've ever had in their life. Our population is aging just like our communities. We are seeing increased numbers of people with dementia, COPD, coronary artery disease, and hypertension. The increased use of overtime by nursing staff in our facilities has grown exponentially. Between 2017 and 2022, ranges from 120% increase at the Red Wing facility, 166% increase at the Faribault facility, to a 274% increase at Rush City. This leads to hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional costs, not to mention staff burnout. Members, the request for body-worn cameras in our corrections and intensive supervised release agents is one we have brought forward previously, and it was in response to the 2020 OLA audit on facility safety. The recommendation was recently echoed in the DOC Ombuds report on sexual assaults in prisons. We have the ability to provide more accountability and transparency in our prisons for the sake of safety, of the well-being of our staff and the population. And body-worn cameras are an effective and proven way of doing this. There are numerous needs for investments in the safety and operations of the state's facilities. To highlight just a few, similar to prisons across the country, we are seeing an alarming rate of drugs coming into our correctional facilities, oftentimes through the mail, in very sophisticated ways, like soaking drugs and greeting cards and other paper products. The introduction of these drugs result in assaults and overdoses. And after an extensive pilot study to look at different methods of preventing the influx of drugs through the mail, we are requesting about $500,000 to invest in mail scanning technology. Additionally, the core function of food services in our prisons is experiencing a staffing crisis that's unprecedented. Stabilized food services are critical to safe and secure and healthy operations of a state prison. And you'll see a significant request in the governor's recommendation to ensure adequate staffing levels. We are requesting a $1 million a year ongoing to meet the needs and complying with the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act requirements and to ensure that DOJ grants are not reduced in our capacity to comply with these important and critical safety standards. Additionally, we seek funds to update technology and ensure effective communication throughout the facilities. We are requesting $1.5 million a year and ongoing to upgrade the department's armor radios. Members, you have heard from our Fugitive Apprehension Unit a couple weeks ago on a policy bill to clarify their authority and allow them to assist other law enforcement agencies. The unit is in need of additional capacity to keep up with the increased demands of outstanding warrants. Adding officers is a way for the DOC to ensure accountability in our system and keep our community safe. Over time, warrants have increased, now running between 400 and 500 people subject to an active warrant at any given time. We would like to drive this number down significantly, thus this request. Moving on to another budget recommendation of the governor on community is community supervision. And you'll hear more about this topic in the future, so I won't spend the time on it that it deserves today. But please know that this funding is a central priority for the DOC and one we are dedicated to in partnership with counties across our state to adequately and equitably fund the state's probation and supervision systems. This includes a $42 million a year increase for the provision of supervision and probation services, $2.75 million to tribal governments who to provide supervision supports to system-involved people, and $18.7 million in grants for community programming and innovative services to meet gaps across our state. Moving on to investments and how Minnesota can become a leader in evidence-based service delivery, tracking outcomes, and ensuring transparency in our work. Members, you have seen this request from 2022, and the need remains critical. The DOC's data management system and underlying technology foundation are incredibly antiquated. Staff routinely use spreadsheets to track data, provide written reports for documentation, and fax machines to share critical information. This one-time funding request to be developed or spread out over 4 years has two main components. First, it will overhaul the DOC's data management system to bring them in line with modern standards and efficiencies and data collections. And we have a short recorded testimony from Captain Chris Mitchell to help explain the need for this investment.
My name is Chris Mitchell, and I'm a captain. And for the Department of Corrections, I am based out of Faribault, Minnesota. My name is Chris Mitchell.
Can you all hear that?
No. Is the audio through the system?
I don't know.
It is? Okay.
Can I turn off the computer?
Yeah, it was relative.
And I'm a captain for the Department of Corrections. I am based out of Faribault, Minnesota, and I'm coming up on
Well, in the front.
Let's just stop.
It works so good when we practiced it.
For the service with the DOC. There's several, and we'd be here. Be here a long time to just grab all of them, but.
I'm wondering, Commissioner, in the interest of time, if we can just share a link for this video to members
Absolutely.
And then post it on our website.
Yeah.
All right, great.
So I'll proceed. So the second part of the investment will take this updated data management system at the DOC and link it to a newly created public safety data hub. This will provide real-time information across our system and to increase public safety outcomes and data-driven decision-making. The creation of this data portal will provide a central uniform tool for law enforcement, supervision, and probation agents, the courts, and the DOC with all having access and sharing the same data. This will be provided more directly and efficiently using 21st century data tools and supports. The governor is also recommending creation of an evidence-based practices unit at the DOC to evaluate the effectiveness of all aspects of secure confinement, treatment, programming, and community supervision. And to maintain research on best practices across the field of corrections, and to ensure that the state is investing resources.
Information sharing. We currently still use fax and share.
No, it won't stop.
This is like a reflection of the DOC technology.
Yeah. On the ID request.
The evidence-based practices unit will oversee the implementation of what works. How we keep our facilities safe and secure, what programming and how treatment programming is provided, and ensuring the most effective methods of reducing recidivism and revocation while individuals are on community supervision. It will also be responsible for providing quality assurance on programming and supporting statewide training to all DOC staff. Next, accountability and transparency. And oversight must be central to how Minnesota approaches public safety. Yet investments in data analysis, oversight, implementation of policy and procedures, and equity access and inclusion have all fallen short. For example, the DOC currently has just two staff dedicated to equity access and inclusion. We need these people to make sure that we are in alignment with the values and diversity of our state and comply with all federal access requirements. Additionally, the DOC is an agency governed overwhelmingly through by policy, yet we have less than two full-time staff to analyze, oversee, and update over 470 policies. These investments will help ensure robust, effective, efficient oversight and accountability of systems, policies, and services. Moving to the final segment of our presentation, the following investments are in the area of rehabilitation. You have already heard the central tenet of the budget recommendation, the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, or MRRA. MRRA incentivizes people for completing transformative programming by reducing their incarceration and supervision time. The proposal also reinvests savings in system efficiencies and improvements going forward. As you consider increased investments in rehabilitative services, please keep in mind that if we do not bend the curve of recidivism and rehabilitation, there are additional considerations that we will need to face, and that is adding more capacity to our state's prison systems in the coming years. As a reminder, the DOC is shifting the focus and organization of the department to a person-centered approach. Simply put, this approach organizes and matches evidence-based programs and services targeted at the needs of individuals and addressing their risk factors while they're with us. Research tells us this is what works. To effectively fulfill this shift, resources for rehabilitation must follow. Each of these data points on this slide reflect the unique and important challenge to our work and yours. And I hope you will keep them front of mind as you consider making decisions about the Department of Corrections budget throughout this session. We have a video here again, but we're going to try one more time if we can, Madam Chair. Just.
When we use the word rehabilitation, like when a judge sentences someone to the Department of Corrections, they're sending them there for this rehabilitative process. And currently the way it's set up, there is no positive reinforcement for actually joining the programming. So us incentivizing the programming and giving resources and money to this space to incentivize the program, it is one of the ways that we are actually contributing to a safer Minnesota. And for the average incarcerated person, it will give meaning to their days. It will give meaning to the phone calls to their family. It'll give meaning to the visits from their family, because it's a different type of check-in. Hey, how is the programming going? So every time you complete another programming, your family knows you're taking a step closer to your own dreams, and you are also taking a step closer to them. But most people who end up in prison because they were, you know, anti the rules, and following the rules, they feel like never got them nothing good. So if it was to incentivize the programs, even for the people who don't believe in the stuff, muscle memory, you go to the barbershop enough times, you're bound to get your hair cut. So if we get people on the track of, I do good, good things happen for me. I do good things happen for me. It would absolutely shift rehabilitation, and people would be saying, hey, actually, so if I do good, good things happen for me. And that would turn rehabilitation.
You know, I think the DOC does a pretty good job in terms of the breadth of possible, there's lots of different programs, right? Unfortunately, lots of those programs have a very limited capacity because of funding and other things like that. And the more that we can expand some of those programs, the more that we can reduce the wait times to get into those programs, the more people are going to be successful. So today I'm speaking to you from the number one criminology program, in the country. That consists the University of Maryland Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice is consistently ranked as the number one criminology program in the country, if not amongst the top in the world. And I'm here because I finished my PhD at the University of Minnesota. But before that, I started my educational journey in St. Cloud Prison. It was in St. Cloud when I first began taking college courses that eventually led me to go, after I was released, or led me to community college, where I finished there, transferred to the U, finished my undergrad, and then finished my PhD. But if it wasn't for the opportunity to take college courses while I was incarcerated, I never would be in the position where I am today. I have no idea where I would be otherwise, but I know that I wouldn't be here without that opportunity. And so when I look at the possibility, the transformative possibilities of education, I obviously think back to my own experience, but I also think back to the experience of many of the other people I saw go through these programs, and how the opportunities, the chance to be in one of these classes really was like a light switch for many of them, realizing, you know what, there is another way, right? And I think that the more that we as a society, the more that obviously the legislature can support these types of programs, the better off we're going to all be in terms of, our communities and obviously the state of Minnesota.
A lot of times, when people are being reentered into the community, we have to focus on those stability factors for these people. They might not have housing, food, clothing, and so our focus gets put on those things before it gets put on rehabilitation, before we can even work with somebody in promoting that change and increasing community safety.
And so it's important to fund people that are starting fresh so that they're not getting into different mental health circumstances that can help happen, whether it's anxiety, depression, how am I going to do this? I might as well just go back to my old ways because no one's going to give me the opportunity anyway, so I'll just do what I know. It's important to fund them because we spend so much money keeping them in, and an appropriate fund can help people stay out and become productive, which is our model in Minnesota as it relates to rehabilitation. We work with the human population because they're human beings. I'm a firm believer, and I work very strongly with following the law and respecting the law and accountability for that. So in no way do I want this to be something that people get to do and act and behave how they choose, and we need to fund that. I don't think that that's the message we need to give, but we do need to say to those that have been in prison or are coming out or don't want to reenter that we're willing to do something different because life happens to everybody.
Because, you know, a lot of people that are getting out have lost a sense of identity, lost values and things that have been taught to them just due to, you know, drug use, living in survival mode, and, you know, you forget to really work on that healing space that Indigenous people, you know, have within their own lives, you know. And so I think that it's just really important that we include that when we're transitioning people back into community.
I think especially for Native American men, if they have a safe place to come home to that provides support, that provides them with culture, I don't see them failing. I see them exceeding. I feel that I see them, you know, walking with confidence and believing in themselves. And I think that's really important because these are the men in our community. These are our fathers, our brothers, our uncles. When they're coming home, it's hard for them to even find a place to come home to because of the limited amount of housing.
Over the last year, year and a half or so, we've had to create wait lists for our clients. We've had to close down locations or different groups that we're offering because we don't have the staff to provide the service. Not that we don't have the clients that need the service, but we don't have the staff to provide the service. Only an increase in funding would help us be able to treat more clients. Our wait lists could be reduced in size. We would be able to expand the breadth of services that we provide. For example, many of the services that we are required to perform under a contract or for the courts or for probation are things that health insurance does not cover. And so, that increased funding is really needed to bridge the gap between what a client can afford to pay us for services, what their health insurance may cover, and then what we're actually being required to do as a sex offender treatment provider.
We work with a population that struggles to find supportive services, struggles to find stable housing where they would like to live, struggles to find work. We are not able to coordinate case management for our clients because insurance doesn't reimburse for it. And we just don't have the funds. And we really need people with lived experience to help people find stable housing, help coordinate fair chance employment opportunities, do some leadership and education around that, and also just help with other supportive services.
Because these people are our brothers, our neighbors, our friends. We've demonized them, right? Because they've done some terrible things, absolutely. But we've demonized them and othered them in a way that really isn't accurate. They are just like us in so many ways. They have made terrible choices and they've caused a lot of harm, but that doesn't have to define the rest of their life. We can help make the rest of their life look a lot differently, and that's what we're here to do.
I don't know how we can continue to do what we're doing without any assistance because, again, we can't do our jobs, what we are set to do to work with these clients and help rehabilitate them and get them the skills that they need to be successful when we're having to continuously focus on stability factors. I know funding is always a sore topic with everybody. Everybody's, you know, always faces, you know, budget, you know, cuts, mm-hmm. and, you know, wondering, okay, what is least important and what is most important, though it is all important. And I know how difficult it can be, but these people are in our community. And we should do whatever we can to help them start on a successful venture when they're released.
Madam Chair, members, the perspectives provided all relate to a holistic budget request that we have put forward. A significant portion of the budget request is in education, both secondary and higher ed. Just last year, the federal government opened up Pell eligibility for incarcerated individuals, creating enormous opportunities to open up higher education for those in prison, but we need the space, the staff, and the technology to meet that opportunity. This request also invests significantly in ABE, adult basic ed, and special education teachers and staffing capacity to meet the needs of that population and increase positive outcomes upon release. You heard the importance of this investment from others, so I won't belabor the point, but the bottom line is stable housing is a critical component of successful reentry. Housing is cited first and often as the most significant barrier to successful community reintegration. Public safety demands that these individuals reintegrate successfully into communities and not committing further crime. Yet according to the 2021 homelessness legislative report, 1,128 individuals released from prison were released into homelessness. Of those individuals, 57% were Black, Indigenous, or other persons of color. This investment provides supports, resources, and culturally appropriate options for individuals reentering communities facing homelessness. To be very clear, the politics around sex offending and sex offender treatment can be difficult, but the benefits, it couldn't be more clear. Adequate funding for the grant program to increase successful treatment completion rates and decrease victimization and to ensure that individuals are not sent back to prison simply because they could not afford treatment is what this investment is about. We have an opportunity to invest in this critical resource need, and I urge you to support this funding. Preserving strong bonds with family while a person is incarcerated leads to more sustained community ties, promotes rehabilitation, and reduces recidivism. Studies repeatedly find a significant link between family contact and success when returning home. As a reminder from a previous slide, 73% of those in prison are parents. 1 in 6 in Minnesota prisons had a parent that was incarcerated. In fact, it was the most prevalent adverse childhood experience. 40% of children in adult foster care have an incarcerated parent. Yet Minnesota does not have a dedicated resource for family support and stabilization services. The creation of this unit will provide a centralized resource for families and help connect community organizations who provide services and programming that strengthen bonds between incarcerated people and their families. And importantly, the governor's recommendation also invests $2 million to eliminate or reduce the cost of phone calls and video visits. There is significant community support for this change, and the time has come to stop charging incarcerated individuals and their families to keep in contact with their support networks. The budget also has requests around reentry targeted at increasing success of individuals as they rejoin their communities when the stakes are most high. These investments focus on substance use disorder release planning, providing Narcan kits upon release, connecting Native American men with culturally specific programming, and creating a peer support pilot for individuals being released from prison. And the Pathways to Employment Program, a proposal that's reflected in House File 505, carried by Representative Neuer, which you'll hear later today, you'll hear more about. Finally, Chair Moeller and members, if there is one thing I'd like you to take away from our time today is this, that 95% of those in our prisons will return to neighborhoods and communities across the state. Because of this, we must ensure that those in our care, custody, and control, and under our supervision, have access to services and supports they need, because the safety of our state depends upon it. With that, Chair Mueller, I will stand for any questions you or the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. That was an excellent presentation. Do we have member questions? I actually just start. I have a quick question for you. I was just looking at this last, the successful reentry slide number 35 around some addiction-focused release planning. And I just was curious if the department either receives or is eligible for some of the ORAC funding. I'm just trying to learn more about the interactions of the ORAC with all of this.
Madam Chair, members, we do are involved in the ORAC planning group, and we do receive some funds that usually is used for post-release services. But there has been more heavy emphasis on the community side of ORAC funding, which obviously we are equally concerned about for those under probation supervision or supervised release. So that has been, my understanding, where most of those dollars have been invested.
Thank you. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. And one thing I wanted to just lift up, you know, in this space when we talk about corrections, we often talk about, we're talking about recidivism, and I just want to make the connection that when we talk about reducing recidivism, we're also talking about reducing crime. We're talking about preventing crime. We're talking about, you know, all those impacts that happen when people recidivate, which means there's more, you know, we use that language, but I just wanted to kind of call out how important that is when we think about victims and preventing people from becoming victims of crime in the first place, that it, yes, it's important that we are helping these people because they're people and they're community members, and also it is a crime prevention tool and a public safety, you know, public safety in that sense as well. So just wanted to lift that that up in this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Commissioner, I'm trying to be as simple as I can here, and I was talking to Representative Frazier here about this. Do you have a fixed cost on what it costs for one incarcerated person in the state of Minnesota? I mean, I could take your budget and divide it by your total incarcerated right now. That would be the way I'd do it. But what's it cost us to incarcerate somebody?
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, I think, you know, we are looking at roughly a per diem of about $150 a day, thereabouts. Now, if you look at this, some facilities are higher. And it's oftentimes based upon the custody level and the level of services that are being provided. For instance, Oak Park Heights, which generally has a little bit lower population and higher need, that's where our mental health units are at, and our, you know, facility-based medical transition unit is. That the cost, the per diem, is a little bit higher. But when you look across the system, about $150 a day.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. And so, just really quick math there. That's about $54,000 a year per one incarcerated person. That's a big number. And it's not much we can do about it here, but we really have to look at how we can, like Chair Becker-Finn was saying, prevention, keep them out of your facility. So thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Ingham. Sorry, someone just handed me a note, and so I was trying to.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. To Representative Hewitt and to Commissioner Schnell, I think that the way that we want to think about how this is going to impact Minnesotans in their day-to-day lives, we want to make sure that we have the safety of all of us in our communities prioritized before a dollar figure for a per diem housing allowance. We want to make sure that we're actually thinking about, are they truly rehabilitated, or are we potentially releasing somebody that isn't ready? Two things can be true at once, that those programs are working, but we also need to maintain a warehousing staff and corrections facility that protects offenders from reoffending and getting out early in the first place. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you determine the numbers and the governor's budget proposal that that decided how much should go towards those reentry programs versus housing in our facilities currently?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the budget reflects both. It reflects the reality that we have to, we do house these people, and that it does serve the state's incapacitation objective of holding people in custody. And there are people in our prisons that for very good reason will never ever be out. But that's not the reality. That's not the majority. And so when we look at this, we have to constitutionally, I would remind you, provide services to these people, whether they're going to be there for a month or they're going to be there for the entirety of their life to their last dying breath. We need to provide them with the care and basic levels of services. So our correctional facilities do provide both that incapacitation objective, but that's only one objective of the criminal justice system. The other objectives that are equally important are things like rehabilitation and reentry and reintegration. These are and have to be lifted up as well. And the challenge we have is our investments have traditionally been on having people locked up in the facilities, which, again, it's one side. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin has to be rehabilitation.
Representative Ingham.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you for that. I agree. It has definitely been a pendulum that has swayed more towards warehousing. But I think that the pendulum's swaying the other way now, because we're seeing programs that can pay for college. I took out loans. I went to college. I have to pay those back monthly. I'm not sure that is the best use of our DOC funding. So when we think about these things, just make sure that the pendulum isn't swinging in the other direction. That would be my ask.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I want to be really clear about the investments in this college education stuff come as a result of the United States Congress reinstating Pell funding for people who are incarcerated, which was signed into law by President Trump, and is and reflects historic policy that was in place for decades and decades. Again, I too paid those student loans. And yet, when the federal government looked at this and when this was passed on a bipartisan basis in Congress, it was because there was a recognition that those investments would pay dividends down the road. And that's, I think, what this is about. So the higher education opportunities, while there's a components of this that help support that majority of that is going to be provided by Minnesota State colleges and universities through Pell funds, grant funds, that are made available by the federal government.
Anything further, Representative Ingham?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just noting, I don't think there's anybody here, at least on the, I don't think there's anybody here on the higher ed committee, but just a reminder that, we've got all kinds of students who have a lot of debt that have built up, that the state support for our public higher ed system is way below what it was in decades past. It used to be that the state provided 3/4 support, and I think it's now flipped, provided 1/4 support. I guess I hate to have it be that rather than having it be that we would prevent folks from getting on a better path, receiving higher ed, and the opportunities there for some people, we really want to make sure that everybody does. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of expounding upon the comments of other members thus far, I want to try to, I'm going to present a perception, and then I'd like you to speak to it and correct it. Because when I look at this from a broad view, I see, speaking to Representative Ingham's point about doing things the right way, being law-abiding, staying out of trouble, being forward-thinking, taking out loans, going to school, I think folks who followed that path, some folks who followed that path, when they look at the prospect of funding an education for folks who have taken a very different path that's been much less constructive, there's a natural tension there. I think the outcome of having people rehabilitated and having people productive and not having recidivism and I was really struck by the video testimony from the former incarcerated person who said you should be encouraged to do good things. Absolutely. I think the tension comes from people who are like, well, I've done that my whole life. I've always done the good thing. I didn't get in trouble. And I didn't have anything handed to me. And so is there an opportunity here to ensure that folks who are being incentivized to do the right thing are taking on a fair degree of the financial burden in a similar way as somebody who takes out a student loan does, so that they have to actually carry that with them and participate in the cost of what it is that we're providing for them?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunstad, I absolutely understand that perspective. I mean, I think any of us look at this and we have to, I think, you know, look at the reality that, that folks ending up in this system, they're, I don't know of anybody, and I certainly wouldn't trade going to prison to get a college education. That would not be my choice. And I think, you know, for some of these people have made poor decisions. Many of them have had challenges in their lives, as was pointed out. I don't want to make excuses for them. They're there, and they're being held to account. At the same time, and this is not simply about money either, but it is a pay one way or pay another proposition. And I think that's how we have to think about this when we get to the cold, hard facts of the cost for this. We are going to pay one way or we are going to pay another. And I think it's time for us to invest in the side of we're going to double down. And all the research tells us that that's going to pay a dividend. And we need to double down on that side and make sure that folks are coming out and doing what we want them to do, living the good life, going to the barbershop, as Mr. Reese talked about in the video, going to the barbershop multiple times, and eventually you get your hair cut. And what we want to do is create every opportunity for people to get the good stuff and have the good stuff, because on the other side of that is coming back to the community and paying their share of the taxes, paying their share of helping to make sure that their kids do good. And we can't hide from the reality or the facts that these folks do have kids. We want those kids. We need to break these generational cycles. These types of investments are going to make a difference, and we want to be in a place where investing in them, we can prove. And I've said to the people who are the experts in corrections in this state, and asked experts in other states, will these investments, if we do them right in an evidence-based way, make a difference? And to a person, the answer is yes. If we can do them and deliver them in the way that the evidence supports, we can and we will produce better outcomes. That's what this is about for us. Good lives for them, less costs for us, and just really being about making sure that we're breaking these cycles that from my days in law enforcement, I saw repeated cycles, generations of people who were in the system, and we need to break that.
Thank you. We're going to move on, but I have a follow-up question to that, too. And I'm just curious, Commissioner, if you know how many people who are incarcerated are people who are in poverty before they're even incarcerated. I'm imagining that the number is quite high.
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact number, but we do know that many of these people came out of a history of generational poverty.
And Commissioner, I'd also like to know how much, I know there are different jobs people can do while they're incarcerated, and can you please remind us what amount they earn for those jobs?
Madam Chair, the wages for people who work in prison or participate in different programming ranges from 25 cents per hour to $2 an hour for the vast majority of jobs. There's a small number of jobs that we do for private industry where there's interstate requirements that can go as high as 11, but that's a very small number of jobs.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner. And then one more question about related to restitution. Do you know either what the average restitution amount is for somebody who's incarcerated, or how many percentage of incarcerated people have restitution that they need to pay?
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact number, but I can tell you that we will get that information and provide that to you. I would also say this, however, that we do collect restitution even on the wages that we do pay.
Right, thank you. And I just wanted to get that information because I think it's important when we're talking about folks' ability to be able to help pay for some of these services, that if they're coming in poverty, they're barely making anything with the jobs that they have while they're incarcerated. They have restitution, they may have child support and other obligations as well, that there are a lot of pressures financially on these folks. Let's see, we have Representative Frazier and then Vice Chair Feist. Go ahead.
And I know you want to move on, Chair, so I'll be quick. But thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Snell, I've said this to you multiple times. I like your approach. You're being innovative. You're thinking outside the box. And in some ways, you're catching up because some other states are already doing these things. Mm-hmm. I know Minnesota's often seen as more progressive, but when it comes to our criminal justice system, our DOC, we're not that progressive. So I know you're trying to move us forward there to align with some other states. And this is states that would be considered red or blue states, if you want to talk about from the political perspective. But what I want to say is the approach you're taking, you know, I look at how, if you just look broadly at our country and the way we do invest in things, and that's from the cradle to the grave. Other countries that are similar in size, similar in gross GDP, they invest differently. They invest more in education. They invest more in services that ensure people have good job trainings and have access to housing and have access to good retirement. We just simply don't do that here in this country, right? And I hear the conversation about, well, are we giving handouts and are we going to make sure that the community is safe? Are these people truly rehabilitated? We incarcerate at a high level in this country. But per capita, we are not safer than countries that don't incarcerate at the same level. So that argument just doesn't fly well with me when we talk about safety. Because if you just look at the numbers and say, well, if you incarcerate more people, you're safer, we would be the safest country or one of the safest countries in this world. But we are not. And I think we really have to think about that. So I like the approach you're taking. I like the perspective that you have. And I said this to you when I was in Lionel Lakes talking with folks the other day. I appreciate the courage that you're having to try to push back and disrupt and change and reform a system that has been very resistant to that. So I appreciate you.
Vice Chair Feist, and then we'll call Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to also talk a bit about the demographics of folks who are incarcerated, just to highlight the fact that we know a lot of them are victims of crime. Some studies show as high as 80% of people who are incarcerated are also victims, and we talk a lot about supporting victims, and I think that is an important data point to really keep in mind. We also know that a high number of incarcerated Minnesotans suffered from the adverse childhood experiences, those ACEs. So these are kids who grew up having experienced a traumatic childhood. So I think, you know, those are the people that we're talking about in large part. And then just a personal anecdote, one of my employees at my law firm took a paralegal certification class while she was incarcerated. She rocks. She's doing a great job. And it was because she had that education that she was able to step into the role. So I've seen the really amazing impact of these types of programs, and I really am supportive. Thank you. Lee Novotny.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. Thank you for being here, Commissioner Snell. One quick question, might be a little more complex, but you talk about the daily cost of the incarceration. If we have $150 average more for Oak Park Heights, what does a program like Togo run a day?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Novotny, I don't exact number, but it's probably in the vicinity. It can be a little bit higher simply because there's a small number of people and you're providing a lot of services to run the boot camp. But we, again, know that the dividends paid because of that program and the effectiveness of challenge incarceration, it's less in the long haul.
Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. And that ties into my second question. You discussed the addiction-focused release programs and also tying into we need to do something about the 1,100 roughly people released in homelessness. Can you just expand a little bit what you're talking about with that addiction release program and Are there, is this something that DOC is going to be doing? Is this going to be tying into some nonprofits that pick these people up and start working with them to make a transition to integration?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, you know, we do have release planning services in a variety of areas, including like people who are complex medical needs. This simply would be release planners that work with those community resources you're referencing and make sure that there's a warm handoff and connection, because we know that that's going to lead to better outcomes.
Okay. Lee Novotny.
Last question, and do we have some estimate, and maybe I missed that, how much are we looking at putting towards that program?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, we'll pull that out here. The release planning would be, there's a $1.357 million in ongoing health services release planning more broadly, and that includes a breakdown of, and it's in the one pager. And then there's also some culturally specific release programming and planning that's also included with this.
Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Commissioner Schnell, and thank you, Chair Moeller. And it just, yeah, having something for that gap and having them a place to go, especially at a time we've got such low unemployment rates, we can get people into industry and make that transition. I think that would make great strides to reducing recidivism. Thank you.
Thank you. And as you know, we'll be hearing some more of those bills just in a few minutes here today. Thanks again, Commissioner. Really appreciate your time and your presentation.
Thank you,
Looking
Madam.
Forward to seeing the bill.
Thank you.
Thanks. Next up, we have the Ombuds for Corrections budget overview presentation. And welcome back to the committee, Ombudsperson Zadra.
Thank
Go
you.
Right ahead and introduce yourself, and you can begin your presentation.
Thank you. I get adjusted here. It's hard to see the screen, so if I'm not forwarding on, please give me a holler. Good afternoon, Chair Moeller.
If you don't mind just pulling the mic a little bit closer to you, that'd be great.
All right. How is that?
That's better. Thank you.
All right. Good.
Is it on? I don't know. Now I don't know.
Is it not on? Okay. I'll move this stuff over a little bit. All right. So, Chair Moeller and committee members, my name is Margaret Zadra, and I am the Ombudsperson for Corrections. Really grateful to be here today. The mission of our office, as you know, a lot of you worked really hard to recreate the office in the 2019 session, and our mission is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. Our office is completely separate and independent from the Department of Corrections, and we can investigate complaints from incarcerated people, staff, and community members. We can facilitate resolutions, make recommendations, and publish reports. We can provide education and provide information to help people navigate a really challenging and difficult system. So, Minnesota, we just heard a lot about this, but Minnesota state's prisons and local correctional facilities confine and control thousands of incarcerated adults and juveniles and place staff in really difficult work environments. So they're difficult environments to live in and difficult environments to work in. With the office, incarcerated individuals and their families and staff members can voice concerns and complaints to our office for impartial and transparent consideration. Drawing upon our work with incarcerated individuals, we can look for improvements and recommend changes to the governor and commissioner and to you here in the legislature in order to promote efficiency, justice, and fairness. So I didn't want to go forward just yet. Sorry about that. In recreating the office, the legislature also viewed the office as a way to make prisons and jails safer for both incarcerated individuals and staff. We do this, we increase safety by for incarcerated individuals because they can turn to our office with complaints about concerns about unsafe situations and conditions, and we can help resolve those. And we promote safety for our corrections staff because we provide a productive option for for incarcerated individuals frustrated by circumstances that might lead to conflict if they didn't have the office to turn to for impartial investigations. I also want to highlight just a couple of things that were mentioned a little bit ago. Particularly when we're talking about these reports, they have real consequences. So the sexual assault report that was noted a little bit earlier when the commissioner was speaking, we made a recommendation there for body-worn cameras. It's just in the governor's budget request. That report represented months and months and months of investigations by our office and staff, and really represented complaints from a number of incarcerated people and their family members. And we were able to review overall processes. I did just receive a letter from somebody that was one of those initial people that helped compel to move that from an individual investigation in order to a bigger, larger systemic investigation. And they were incredibly overwhelmed by feeling like what they had brought forth actually made a substantive change. And, you know, that's not always the case. Sometimes people aren't happy with the work our office does. But in general, even if we're not able to substantiate somebody's claims, we're often able to look at the overall processes and provide relief or recourse or resolution in some way. I also want to just really briefly highlight some of the strengthening families items that were noted earlier by the commissioner. We had a long-term report related to supporting families and having that family education and communication. And that has been ongoing. Report started 2 years ago now. That report long published, and then we've moved beyond that and developed pilot projects to continue those conversations, education, and opportunities for family members. One other thing, as we were just talking and Representative Feist just mentioned, we know that a lot of people who are incarcerated have experienced immense amounts of trauma in their lives. We also know that staff experience trauma on a daily basis. And so repeatedly we were seeing situations where staff may not have had the support that they needed or the additional training that they may have needed to deal with some really complex situations. And so one of the things our office initiated was a training that we put forth at the Minnesota Corrections Association conference earlier this year on trauma-informed complaint fatigue for corrections staff. And a lot of what we focused on that was both staff experiences and the people they serve and their experiences and some really practical ways to address compassion fatigue in a trauma-informed way. In order to both support their experiences and the experience of the people that they serve. So a couple little brief examples. Our office has, when fully staffed, 5 full-time staff, and all staff are involved in investigations. We have a variety of different backgrounds and experience, including law, policy, law enforcement, corrections, experience, investigation, social work, and lived experience. Current budget year, we have $663,000, which theoretically supports 5 full-time staff, but we haven't been fully staffed this whole calendar year. I fulfilled dual roles for the past year, and so some pieces of our office, we were still able to respond to all complaints, but we suspended some of the promoting of promising practices due to capacity and resources. We also had to really prioritize which cases we took because of resource issues. With those salary savings this past year, though, we were able to not have to lay anybody off and still pay for all of our IT costs and training. I just want to note that our budget equals less than 0.1% of the DOC budget. So I feel like we're a pretty good bargain. Although we're completely neutral and independent from the DOC, when the office was newly created in 2019, it was originally placed within the DOC budget. And
for the last budget cycle that was separated to ensure that full independence. We do contract with SMART for our finance and HR needs. As you can see, the governor's recommended budget is $1.1 million for this next fiscal year and $1.1 again when you round it off thereafter. That does maintain 5 full-time staff and allows for additional staff. We're hopeful to hire an, at least one more investigator and an admin staff. And then we have growing IT and data needs that would also cover. You know, that's a really brief overview, but it's a pretty small budget, so I'm happy to answer any questions or get into more detail if you have any questions.
Thank you so much. Do we have any member questions? Oh, I'm getting some feedback. Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I don't get any feedback. Is that okay? You mentioned that you've had to take on dual roles this past year, and also you had to suspend some of the programming or things that you would have, practices you would have liked to done. Can you talk about the programs that you had to suspend?
We were
go ahead, Ombudsperson.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Frazier. We had been doing a Promoting Justice series, which was a monthly series where we highlighted and presented promising practices in corrections. So that was one of the things that I personally enjoyed most and just didn't continue to have capacity for doing. Some of the other outreach and collaboration with other groups ended up not happening as much as I would have preferred. And I'd also had big aspirations to develop a robust intern program, and that has also been delayed. Our statute also allows us to receive grants, and we had looked at some policy research opportunities that might be helpful in kind of moving forward some of the research that we think would support some of the systemic things that we're looking at, and that also has been put on pause.
Anything else, Representative Frazier?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Does this budget reflect what you need to do those things that you've had to forego?
Yes.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Any other member questions? Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate you spending your time with us on a Friday morning. All right, members, with that, we're going to move on to bill presentations. The first bill we have on our agenda is a Representative Wolgamott bill, House File 1816. I don't know how to stop. I didn't see you come in, Representative Wolgamott, so I wasn't quite sure you were back there. I will move to lay over House File 1816, and I believe that you also have an A1 amendment, which I will move. And when you are settled in, if you want to explain your A1 amendment, please.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be back in your committee here on this Friday morning. I appreciate you moving my A1 author's amendment. This amendment is 5% of the appropriated amount of what this bill is doing is used to reimburse the Department of Corrections for their reasonable cost to administer this programming.
All right, great. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. And if you want to go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended, Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, for your support for the A1 amendment and for the opportunity to come before you this morning to present House File 1816. House File 1816 appropriates $2 million in fiscal year 2024 from the Department of Corrections for a grant to the Redemption Project to provide inmates with curriculum and corporate mentors while incarcerated and meaningful employment upon release from a correctional facility. I'm excited to bring this bill before you today in support of continued funding for the Redemption Project. Last session, Madam Chair, this committee appropriated funds that went to the Redemption Project for them to bring the same programming that they've been successfully administrating in the federal prison system here into our Minnesota state correctional system. In their work to reduce recidivism through meaningful employment, the Redemption Project programming has been growing into more state prisons. And with this funding that we're seeking here in House File 1816, they'll be able to serve even more incarcerated individuals across Minnesota, further reduce recidivism rates, and make sure that the communities in my district and in your district are more safe. And with that, Madam Chair, I have some testifiers here who can tell you and the members of your committee more about the incredible work that the Redemption Project is doing and how much this appropriation would mean for them to fulfill their mission.
Thank you. And I believe the first person on our list is Tim Owens. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Good morning. My name is Tim Owens, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Redemption Project. In 2016, I was incarcerated in the federal prison in Rochester for 14 months on an obstruction of justice charge. I'd never been touched by the criminal justice system, and so I did not know what to expect when I went into prison. I was surprised when I went in to learn the number of people that returned to prison and the amount of recidivism that occurs. So that prompted me to want to learn more of why that happened. And there's four primary factors that contribute to that. You already heard from Commissioner Schnell about housing being one of the major obstacles. But in my discussions with inmates and with staff, we found that employment was a huge obstacle to reentry into our communities. So myself and our other co-founder, Dwight Tostenson, our president and CEO, began researching this. When I was released in 2017, we discussed that the number one issue why employment was so important, other than the obvious, is it gave people hope. These people want to come back to our communities, be good members of the communities, and to do that, they need meaningful employment. So our mission at the Redemption Project is to reduce the destructive cycle of recidivism through meaningful employment. Nationally, 2 out of 3 people released from prison return within 3 years. Our vision is to flip that statistic on its head. Our proven model, developed by former inmates, can achieve that goal. From our work in the federal prison, we have 53 individuals who have been released from prison, and of those, only 3 have returned to prison. And to note, 2 of them were on technical violations. Our 3-step program works to educate through a rigorous 14-week academic class, advocate for inmates to be matched with employment mentors and partners to hire them upon release, and thirdly, to support them as they transition back from prison into society, which we all know is a difficult task. In this transition, we continue to assist them working with their employment mentor and life mentors, while we also help with connecting them to resources to assist with other barriers like transportation, housing, and education. We also work with employers to educate them on the benefits of second chance hiring and best practice models. We're currently conducting our program with inmates at the facilities in Stillwater, Lino Lakes, and Rust City. There are about 50 men enrolled, and we have sizable waiting lists. 57% of our participants are people of color, and 40% of our participants have a child that is a minor. Our program costs roughly $5,000 per participant versus the average yearly cost to incarcerate someone in Minnesota of $55,000. The result of our program leads to better lives for our participants, safer communities, economic savings, and assist in addressing our workforce shortage. Thank you for your time today, and we would greatly appreciate you supporting our mission by supporting this bill.
Thank you. And next up, before you begin, I know the testifiers were asked to do 2 minutes each, and I just want to keep us going. What you have to say is really important, but I want to make sure we get through all the bills and all the people who are here to testify today. Next up, we have Tom Pippin.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. And good morning to you all. My name is Tom Pippett, and I have a very brief story about my story here. In 2011, I was given a 10-year sentence and served time at the Federal Medical Center down in Rochester. When I first went into prison, I kind of thought my life was over. I thought I gave up a lot of hope in my life, but it took a little time for me to get back and start realizing I needed to move forward. One of the programs that helped me tremendously was the Redemption Project's Virtue for Success class. In that class, I learned the 4 cardinal virtues of wisdom, courage, self-control, and justice. But another thing I learned was to start believing in myself and start getting my confidence back in what I could do when I could get out and moving forward. Another area that the Redemption Project helped me, and I know as it helped others, is in the employment, getting employed. When I first got out of prison, I was in the halfway house on Lake Street, and I set up, within 2 months, I set up 10 to 15 job interviews. Each job interview started out very well. They liked my education, they liked my work experience, they liked my communication skills, and the fact that I wanted to work for their company. But I said in each interview, at the end, I was going to broach my felony to make sure I could explain it to them. And as soon as I talked about my felony, the light started going out. They thanked me profusely for coming to the interview. They told me I had a great resume and would get back to me about a job, whether I got it or not. And in every case, I never heard back one way or the other. I got very discouraged. But shortly after that, Tim Owens and the Redemption Project reached out to me and wanted to meet with me and see how I was doing. And during that meeting, they said they had a job opening and offered me a job. That job has allowed me to move forward. It has allowed me to put a roof over my head, to feed myself, to buy myself an accessible van for my wheelchair. And most important, well, maybe not most importantly, but one of the factors that I really realize is now I am now a taxpayer again. And my father always told me, the more you pay in taxes, the more successful you are. So I'm feeling like I'm being successful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your testimony. And those are the only two testifiers I had on my list. Was there somebody else? Or?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. Do we have anybody from the public who wish to testify? Come on up, Mr. Heller. All right, if you want to introduce yourself, and you have, we'll give you 90 seconds, Mr. Heller. Welcome.
Just for the record, 90 seconds is discriminatory for a person that can process it, but just thank you again for your consideration that I can come and speak today. My name is Rick Heller. I'm an official represent the Twice Exceptional Print Disabled. If you go to 1269 delete all in the House file, which is a governor's bill, on page 14, you'll find the word Twice Exceptional. Also, if you go to page... Yeah.
Mr. Heller, we're on House File 1816 right now. Did you have something specific to that?
Right. I was just going to express, as it relates to the print disabled, the governor's putting that in his bill on page 127 of that delete all bill.
That's not that. That's not this bill, Mr.
But
Heller.
Because I unofficially represent them, I'm trying to express that because it's a lingual word, starting in the statute. Now I'm going to talk about the bill, if I may.
If it's House File 1816.
1816. The reason I like to say I support this bill, because in 1965, they looked at the prisons and found out there's a lot of illiteracy in the prisons. So shortly after that, they created the Elementary Secondary Education Act to target those individuals that weren't effectively acquired the printed word. We are going digital for a reason. When the feds cited the State Department here for corrections, within a year ago, they were discriminating against people with disabilities, perhaps print disabled, however you want, but I do support a bill that pushes on the fact that when people are getting out of incarceration to be welcome in the public, that they're a functional person, including how they acquire information effectively.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Thank you for your testimony. All right, we're going to move on now to member discussion. Any questions about House File 1816? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say very briefly that I support this, and I thank you, Representative Wolgamont, for bringing the bill, and just a little bit of personal experiences to what drives me to support this. I have worked as a manager of workforce, and in one of the organizations that I've worked for, one of my best coworkers, who was also a manager, ended up being dismissed because something was discovered about his background, and he was a rock star. And I've also found in the course of recruitment and onboarding that the best candidates I always get worried when they haven't gone through the background check yet and they're going through that process, that the more promising they are, the more likely it seems to be that something's going to get flagged on the background and we're not going to be able to bring them on. And with the workforce situation being such that it is, I think there are some employers who would actually appreciate a shift in the way we approach this. So, thank you.
Great. We have Representative Hewitt and Representative Novotny, and then we'll move on. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. I just want to say thank you, Representative Wilgemont, for this great bill. You and I have talked many hours on this bill, and you've been able to introduce me to quite a few of the success stories of this, and this is exactly what we need to help people along and move them on so recidivism doesn't repeat itself. So thank you. You have, you know, I signed on to the bill right now, actually.
All right, and we're seeing more. Really fast note, Representative Mueller first. Go ahead.
I'm so sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, Representative Wilgemont, I'm a co-author on the bill because of how important I think this is. And you know, when I was out campaigning, I actually ran into someone who was starting their own business. And one of the reasons I did it is because as they got out of prison, they were struggling to find someone who was willing to employ them. And they were going to make sure that their life was turned around and they were going to provide for their family. And so they chose literally the hardest road possible of starting their own business. But having something like this is going to be incredibly impactful. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And Representative Ingen.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. And thanks, Representative Wilgemont, for bringing this forward. The word that really sticks out to me is hope. A lot of people don't have that. And, you know, your guys's experience, having gone through those processes within corrections, I think that gives you guys a whole new light that you can approach this through. I want to say thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I'll echo Representative Hewitt. I actually just signed on as well. So thank you.
All right. Any closing comments, if you can be brief, Representative Wilgemont?
Well, thank you again, Madam Chair and members. Let's invest in redemption. Let's reduce recidivism rates, and I urge your full inclusion of House File 1816 in your finance omnibus bill. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 1816 as amended. Thanks again to the testifiers. Really appreciate you being here today. Next on the agenda is House File 505, Representative Knorr's bill. I will move to lay over House File 505, and we also have a DE1 amendment, and I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author desires. Because it's a DE, we're just going to go straight to that vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Go ahead, Representative Knorr, and tell us about your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Shall I say good afternoon, because it's almost at that time. So, Madam Chair and members, House File 505 is Pathways to Employment, something that is so dear to me. It's always something that I call from jails to jobs. We all understand the challenges that we're facing in the workforce development today with the workforce shortage. This is an opportunity to create a pathway for so many people who have been left out. House File 505 is a bill to invest in stronger pathways from prison to employment to investment at the Minnesota Department of Correction. In your packets, you see an explanation for the pathways to employment. Members, we must make public policy based on what works, evidence-based, proven system, and this bill, Madam Chair and members, is created to address those issues. Crime and public safety are also closely linked to social determinants of health, when we look into safe housing, employment, education, and other basic needs that all Minnesotans must have access to. Members, public safety relies on people having what they need, staying employed, supporting themselves and their families, making sure that they have a living wage. This bill makes investment whereby direct connection from employment to public safety is plainly clear. When individuals leave prison employed with skills, training, and education, we are all safer. They can then support themselves, their families, and also invest in their future. Madam Chair and members, with this bill, we're investing $3.55 million a year on an ongoing basis. First, the bill creates an economic opportunity public safety unit at the DOC, an interagency unit to develop and strengthen the relationship in community and between state and employers to connect individuals leaving prison with employment. Second, it invests in and also expands the current DOC employee program, making it available to all persons released from state prison facilities. Employ is a data-driven, evidence-based program to increase employment readiness among the incarcerated and connections to and maintaining living wage jobs for those released from facilities. Third, finally, it funds community-based programming and services for pre- and post-released employment and vocational services, including job readiness and career pathways. Madam Chair and members, thank you so much for hearing me, and I have testifier who will also go through the bill.
Thank you, and I know you're not Commissioner Schnell, so go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair Mueller and members of the committee, my name is Safia Khan, and I'm the Chief of Staff at the Minnesota Department of Corrections. It's good to be here before you today. Commissioner Schnell is here, but he's dealing with some emerging issues at one of our facilities, so I will testify on his behalf. So I just want to thank Representative Noon for authoring this bill that meets two challenges we know Minnesota is facing today, public safety and workforce shortages. The investment is also in the governor's budget bill. We must have a comprehensive approach to crime and ensure we are investing in what works to keep our communities safe. Representative Noor has laid out the bill really well. This request is all about giving opportunities to people to succeed when they return to our communities after incarceration. As an important reminder, over 95% of those who are in our prisons are going to return home to our communities. Our safety depends on their successful reintegration into our society. This package helps improve the chances of that happening by paving pathways from prison to employment. People who are gainfully employed have a much better chance of succeeding when they are back in the community, and as you all know. The DOC's 2022 homelessness report found that 25% of those released from our prisons are leaving homeless, not just because of a lack of affordable housing or barriers to finding housing, which are really key, but also simply because they cannot afford rent because they don't have jobs. The unemployment rate for formerly incarcerated people stands at around 27%. This number ties directly to so many other data points around homelessness, recidivism, and public safety, as Representative Becker Finn's comments mentioned earlier. Part of the work that will come from this package will help develop and strengthen new relationships in the community, bring together both public and private sector employees, trades and trade unions, and job readiness programs. Employment navigation will further pave the pathways that begin in prison to continue into long-term job stability outside prison. The proposal will also help those who come to DOC for only a short period of time and aren't able to engage in programming, gain some stability to get back on their feet. The staff that will be funded by this funding will work on building partnerships with private and public sectors, sector employers, and help pave these pathways to employment. Chair and members, as legislators, I know you see better than we do what opportunities lie here. The communities that you serve and represent and the businesses that exist within them are struggling with both crime and a severe workforce shortage. We know that people who have been incarcerated can make excellent workers. In fact, people returning from prison are often more loyal to their employers because they know decent jobs with employers willing to take a chance on someone with a felony conviction can be hard to come by. And that's a big reason DOC and our partners are hearing more and more these days from companies in your communities and from our trade unions. From a solar power plant on the Iron Range to glass manufacturers in Faribault, from metal producers in Ham Lake to aluminum smelting firms in Rosemount, employers are struggling and eager to partner, but we don't have the capacity to meet the needs. Last year, we met with several trade unions, electricians, carpenters, building and construction, boilermakers, and bricklayers, and they all had the same requests. Help us help the businesses our members serve by connecting us through these pathways. This bill will greatly expand the capacity of the DOC to carry out the mission we are held to, invest in what works to transform lives for a safer Minnesota. With that, Chair and members, I stand for any questions you may have.
Thanks, and we're gonna move on to member discussion, and we have Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, thank you, Chair Noor, for bringing this forward. I just wanted to, speaking to workforce shortages, which we've talked a lot about on the human services side of things, and we don't always hear about that here in the Public Safety Committee, so I just kind of wanted to bridge those two and talk about how we're really, really focused on a multi-layered approach this session to address the workforce shortage, and so I really appreciate bills like this because on the human services side, we're reevaluating processes that are currently barriers for folks with served sentences. So again, I'm really glad to see that the work that we're doing in one area and in another area are just gonna come together so well to hopefully solve some of these challenges for us, so thank you.
Further member discussion? Anyone over there? Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for your testimony, for presenting this bill to us. Do you want to have any closing comments, Representative Knorr?
Madam Chair and members, this is a good bill, so I'm hoping everybody will support it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 505 as amended. Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 1134. It's a Representative Lee bill, and I will move that House File 1134 be re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Representative Lee also has a DE1 amendment, so I will move that, and because it's a DE, we'll just move right to the vote. All those in favor of the DE1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 1134 as amended. So, members, I'm bringing this bill forward because over the last few biennium that I have served on capital investment, we have seen an increase in requests for county jails or public safety centers or law enforcement center. And so I really feel like, you know, if local units of government are reaching out to the state for capital requests, that we should have, at the very least, you know, DLC, the Department with Oversight over county jails and whatnot, or if the licensing of that, provide us with information on whether, you know, it is actually a true need for us. And so that's why I have the bill before us, the Regional and County Jail Studies and Report. So in subdivision of the bill requires a study from the Commissioner of Corrections and to make recommendations on the consolidation or merger of county jails and alternatives to incarceration for persons experiencing mental health disorders. And the Commissioner must engage and solicit feedback from citizens who live in the community served by the facilities that may be impacted by the Commissioner's recommendations for the consolidation or mergers of jails. And then the commissioner must consult with county sheriffs, county and city attorneys that prosecute offenders, chief law enforcement officers, administrators of county jail facilities, and district court administrators. And then subdivision two is the report. The commissioner must file the report with the chairs and ranking members of the Senate and House Public Safety and Capital Investment Committee with recommendations before December 1st of 2024, and then at a minimum, the report must have the following information: the daily average number of offenders incarcerated in each county, a jail facility, and then we also ask about, you know, those that are in pretrial detention, those that cannot afford to pay bail, for failure to pay fines and fees, for offense that stems from controlled substance addiction or mental health disorders, for non-felony offenses that are detained pursuant to contracts with other authorities, and for supervised release and probation violations. And then furthermore, what really gets down to, I think, you know, the piece around capital investment is the actual cost of building a new jail facility, purchasing another facility, or to repair a current facility. And so I think in considering all of that, they have to consider the county population totals and trends, the county crime rates and trends, and the proximity of current jails to courthouses, probation services, social services, treatment providers, and work release employment opportunities. And then also specific recommendations for alternatives to incarceration for persons experiencing mental health disorders, and any specific recommendations on the consolidation or merger of county jail facilities and operations. And then for subdivision three, this is where, you know, when MMB goes through their capital budget process, if local units of government are going to submit any capital requests in the summer of 2021, that in the even year where we traditionally do capital investment, if there are any capital requests for county jails or local jails that the Commissioner of Correction shall submit an evaluation and provide it to, you know, the committees with jurisdiction over public safety and capital investment. And so with that, Madam Chair, that's the bill before us.
Thank you. And I don't think you had any testifiers signed up. Anybody from the public wish to testify? All right, we'll move to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lee, on this. A quick statement on this process, but I think we have to, as a committee, start looking at a more global process. We have a number of bonding requests right now in for fire stations and police stations, and I think we really have to start looking at the full public safety spectrum of doing a study as we lose volunteers in outstate and for ambulance and all that, that we really got to look at regionalization. And I think this is one step towards regionalization of jails, but we also got to look at fire departments, EMS, and possibly even where we park our police cars. So I appreciate this. I think we have to look more globally, though, too. Thank you.
Further member discussion? Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Lee, where's this coming from? Is this something, was this request for this bill generated by the Sheriff's Association or the counties, or what's the origin?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Novotny, this came from me as Chair of the Committee, where we're seeing a lot of requests that are coming from, and I think that it's prudent for us as stewards of the public's dollar for folks who are asking for capital requests from the state that we actually have. I think, you know, the Department of Corrections to weigh in on whether a request is warranted or not. And so this is from me personally.
Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee. Line 2.8 discusses purchasing another facility or repairing the current facility. Would that be referring to something like the Appleton facility that's sitting empty?
Chair Lee.
So, Madam Chair, this is referring to, you know, if when they're doing a request, looking at those that are public. And so this is not looking at that. And, you know, it is up to the Department of Corrections, you know, when they're looking at this. I think what we're trying to get at is when there's a local unit of government that's asking for public money to build a public jail or county jail, that we take a look at that.
Lee Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller.
All right, not seeing any further member discussion. And do you have any closing comments, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, member, for the discussion. And, you know, the concept behind here is similar to what we have already done for the Department of Public Safety regarding law enforcement training facilities. And the last report on that piece was back in 2009. And I think kind of to Representative Hewitt's point, we might need to take a revisit that too. Right now we are seeing, like I said, an influx of requests for not just county jails, but for law enforcement training facilities across the entire state. And so I think it is our duty as, you know, legislators to really make sure that whatever we're investing in are actually needed throughout the entire state. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And I'll renew my motion and re-refer House File 1134 as amended to the Committee on Capital Investment. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2167. It's a Representative Hemmingson-Yeager bill. I will move the bill before us. I'm moving to lay over House File 2167. All right, we have a series of amendments, and we're going to move fast here, members. So here we go. I believe that there is a DE1 amendment, so I'm going to move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author desires. And then we do have amendments to the amendment. And so who will be offering the A2 amendment? Oh, Hudson. Go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A2 amendment is meant to provide some more specific reporting requirements. Specifically, the grant recipient must submit a report to the commissioner that, at minimum, identifies the amount of the grant received, the grant's budget for the program, a detailed list of the expenditures, number of inmates and releasees served by the organization, and then there's also some information requested regarding the impact on recidivism. And the idea here is that, you know, we just want to make sure that this is effective and that we have metrics that can verify that it's accomplishing what we intend it to accomplish, and I'm hoping that it will be received by the author as a friendly amendment.
All right, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, to the amendment, please.
Thank you, Representative Hudson, for the feedback. I appreciate data and making sure that things are doing what they're supposed to be doing. I will respectfully request a no vote for this amendment, simply because if you look at paragraph D of the DE01, the grant recipient is listed in number one. The amount of the grant is numbers 4 and 5. The number of inmates is number 2. The services provided is number 6, and the measurable outcomes are number 7. I will state, too, that in number 7, I do discuss the measures of success, either qualitative or quantitative. As I will describe later, there may not be quantitative measures of success, but there is high value in the qualitative measures. Going down the A1, the recidivism data is not really applicable in this case because these are for people who are currently incarcerated. And they may be for a very long time.
All right, so further discussion to the A2, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you. I read this, so I knew that that stuff was in there, and I appreciate the thoroughness and comprehension of that. I guess one of the things, Madam Chair, and I'll direct this to you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand what the threshold is for when we ask for reports from particular organizations that are requesting money. Because we just had the Redemption Project, and we didn't ask for a report for that organization. So I'm just trying to figure out the threshold. And now I'll leave that here on the record, but I'm just trying to figure out what the threshold is. But thank you, Rep, for putting that in your bill. Appreciate it.
All right, further discussion to the A2 amendment. We'll call again on the author of the A2 amendment, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, for clarifying that there are indeed some reporting requirements in the bill, and I appreciate that. And to speak to, in response to Representative Frazier's question regarding the distinction between this organization and the Redemption Project, I think the difference is what the underlying organizations are providing. So there's some fundamental understanding of the obvious success or failure of an organization that is focused on connecting people who are reentering the community with jobs. We can see whether or not that's happening. It's pretty obvious. The impact on teaching incarcerated people dance on recidivism is not immediately obvious. And so it would be nice to have some kind of tracking of whether or not folks who have engaged with that programming are having a measurable outcome that makes the investment worthwhile. But I understand that all of the particulars of the amendment that I've offered may not be applicable to your DE. I would appreciate being able to have some follow-up conversation about this recidivism point. And in that light, I will go ahead and withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll just note, too, it's awkward doing these amendments to amendments before we had a chance to actually hear the bill and hear about what kind of success the programs had, too. So I do anticipate that we'll be hearing about that in a minute. So next we have the A3 amendment, and I'm not sure who's offering the A3. Lead Novotny, please tell us about that amendment.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. The A3 amendment simply takes the requested funding out of the general fund and pulls that funding out of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, also often called the Legacy Fund. Now, that Legacy Fund may only be spent on arts, arts education, arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history of cultural heritage. Now, the state's already got a pretty good track record of using that money for state agencies and commissions and distribution of those funding for education. I can't think of a better fit for that program and that funding into this program. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager to the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Novotny, for this. I would, again, respectfully request a no vote, simply because this specific project, Art from the Inside, already is included on a contract with the Department of Corrections. And so that tells me that the department already values these types of supportive arts therapy in their programming and their curriculum. And as I will describe when we talk about the bill, that this does do a lot for the incarcerated people. It decreases disciplinary incidents, so I think it is appropriate to keep it within the DOC.
We'll move to discussion on the amendment. Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And I just want to clarify for folks, the legacy funds, there's an entire separate committee that deals with how we spend those dollars, and there are entire groups of people who are appointed to those positions. There's a year-long process where projects are vetted through that process. We should not make it a practice as legislators to just sort of pull dollars out of that fund without it going through the process. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Thanks for that reminder. I've never served on that committee, so I needed that reminder. Other discussion to this amendment? Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just note, too, I mean, I think purposes are really different. So the purpose of the Legacy Fund, as I understand it, is to, you know, expand the arts in Minnesota and all the arts and culture bring us. But this, to my mind, is a public safety expenditure. I mean, this is about helping people to get on a better path, which helps all of us. So that's a core public safety purpose, and it makes a lot of sense to have it come out of the general fund. Thanks, Madam Chair.
All right. We'll end with the author of the amendment, Lee Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. For the presenter, I did not mean to impede what the program does or anything that to imply we don't think it's valuable work. Thought we have an art program through the states collecting money, collecting tax funds. It would seem like that would be the perfect fit for the program. With that, Chair, I request a roll call.
I'm sorry, you're requesting a roll call?
A roll call.
Okay. All right, so we will have a roll call on the A3 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller?
No.
Vice Chair Feist?
No.
Feist, no. Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Novotny, yes. Representative Becker-Finn?
No.
Becker-Finn, no. Representative Curran?
No.
Curran, no. Representative Ingen?
Yes.
Ingen, yes. Representative Fraser?
No.
Fraser, no. Representative Grossel? Oh, he is. Excuse. Representative Hollins?
No.
Hollins, no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Hudson, yes. Representative Hewitt?
No.
Hewitt, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Mueller, yes. Representative Pinto?
No.
Pinto, no. Representative Tapke?
No.
Tapke, no. With 4 ayes and 9 nays, that concludes the roll call vote.
There being 4 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the A3 amendment is not adopted. So now we will take a vote on the DE1 amendment. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. And now you can tell us about your bill as amended, please. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you so much, committee, for your attention this afternoon. I am really honored to be carrying this bill. I think some of the best ideas come within our community, and this idea came from my constituent, Mr. Espinoza. And basically, his program inspired the language for this bill. Programs like these, arts therapy bills, have been shown to increase emotional regulation and coping skills and social skills. They also decrease anxiety and anger, which lead to a decrease in disciplinary incidents and which helps our correction officers and our incarcerated people have better safety inside the prisons. The packets include support from therapists, educators, as well as participants. The participants' letter is actually the same artist who painted this. And the bill appropriates $500,000 to continue this type of work within all of the prisons within DOC. My testifier today, his story is powerful, it's compelling, and it's transformational. So thank you again for your attention.
All right, thank you. And the testifier is Antonio Espinoza. Please introduce yourself, begin your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Mueller and committee members. Thank you for giving me this opportunity today to come and speak to you. My name is Antonio Espinoza, and I'm a former correctional officer. I worked at Stillwater Prison for 19 and a half years, and I'm still committed to work and help our state and working with incarcerated folks inside and outside of the prison walls. I am formerly the founder of Art From The Inside, 501c3, nonprofit that works with incarcerated folks and their art. I'm here for your support today for House File Number 2167, Support Arts Grants Program. My story begins in 2018, July of 18. my coworker was murdered by the hands of an incarcerated person at my institution where I worked at. I was triggered and committed to do something positive from his death. He didn't deserve that. And so through this tragedy, I started thinking about what I could do to try to help the system, to help the incarcerated, help the public. And I was creative enough to incorporate incarcerated art. These individuals are very talented and they have worth. And we need to invest in people who need that help. And not by the dollars, not by how we could do this, but by being human to each other. I'm committed to do this work. I sat at a shower post, and today I'm standing here in front of you asking for your help to help our people, our Minnesotans who need the help that they need. And the DOC needs tools to do this work. I'm retired, but I'm not. I'm very committed to helping the people in Minnesota become better people, be productive people in our society. And we all should be doing that. So today, I ask for a vote yes for this bill. It's gonna help a lot of people. It's gonna help keep our prison safer. It's gonna help keep our streets safer. Our communities is gonna bring us together and make us feel more as Minnesotans. I'm from New York. And everyone said, Minnesota is a nice place. You know, so I have 2 minutes. So thank you very much for Chair Mola for giving me this opportunity to speak for those who can't speak for themselves and to help our incarcerated folks and our staff. Thank you.
Thank you. We didn't have anybody sign up from the public, and in the sake of time, I'll just say if there's anyone from the public who wanted to testify, they could submit written testimony. We'll share that with the committee. We'll move on to member discussion. Chair Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair Mohler. And no offense to the folks who testified from the Department of Corrections today, but I was not expecting a testifier to impact me at this level today. And so I thank you for your testimony and thank you for your service to our state and our community. And I was serving in office when Officer Gum was taken from us, and had really the honor of attending some of the services. And I know how hard, I mean, I don't know, but it's hard to even fathom how hard that must have been for those who knew and served with him. And for you to take something like that and do something like this, if you came in here raging, angry, none of us would blame you. But for you to turn it into something as beautiful as this is just incredibly impactful. And thank you. I it really, really is incredible. And you only spoke for 2 minutes, and you must be a really incredible person to do this work. So now I know why Representative Hemmingson-Yeager got this bill drafted. So thank you so much for being here and for your service and your testimony today.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, brother, we met about a year ago. You introduced me to the program, and I had a chance to walk through the gallery and look at things, and it just touched me seeing those individuals express themselves, do their art, and you get to see a piece of them and know a bit about them without seeing them in person. you know, you could have went a total different way after your loss, after that tragedy. And you chose love and compassion. And that is, you know, that is what I hope for and I wish for in all of our systems and all of the individuals that work in our systems. And so I hope you're a light and I hope you're a beacon that shines through and continues to shine through. And I'm looking forward to, I'm an author on the bill, and I'm looking forward to supporting this and ensuring that you get what you need to keep doing this and expand it, touch more lives, bring more love, more compassion. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Feist. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you as well. I had the opportunity to go through one of your art exhibits and look at the beautiful art and also read about the stories of the artists. And at the Welcome Home event this summer, I got to see one of your artists in action, which was really very, very just moving. And we talk a lot in this committee about quantifiable benefits, you know, recidivism rates, restitution payments, and art is something that is intangible, but it is giving back to the community. It is a way to enrich our world. And so I love the arts. I sing and I draw and I paint. And so I'm just very moved and very impressed. So thanks for being here. I'm excited to support this bill.
And I have a question about this. It's my understanding, too, that art can be really useful as a therapy for people who have disabilities or maybe, you know, the trauma they've experienced in a way that's different from college classes and other employment opportunities, which are all important. But if you could just speak to how art can be used with folks with trauma, that would be helpful.
Throughout my 19 and a half years of working at Stillwater Prison, I encountered many of these individuals with their art, and I always asked them, you know, how do you feel about this art that you're doing? This is amazing work. And, you know, they tell me that they escape from where they're at, and they're in a different space, and it makes them feel calm, and it makes them feel, you know, gratified to do this work. But unfortunately, the public can't see their work. And that's where I was able to get the courage to stand on the front lines and be ridiculed about what I'm doing, because it brings happiness to people. It calms people down. And, you know, I'm not a therapist. I don't know. I couldn't give you a term about that. But I could tell you as a human being that it makes people feel good. You know, and, you know, so, and I'm doing this also just to honor my friend's death. His death means a lot to all of us. And something good has to come out of this. I worked with him for 16 years. Side by side, to know that he's not here today because of the act that happened in 2018. So I'm committed to do something to try to change the system and try to do something positive.
Thank you. And as you talk, I'm reminded of the Cosmic Equine Therapy Bill that we had for first responders, where, you know, they were really unable to explain in many ways how the horses and that kind of therapy was helpful. And I feel like this is very similar to the experience that people have when they're creating art and the work you do with them. Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just this may, maybe Mr. Espinoza knows this, maybe it's for the DOC, but it sounds like part of what you're doing is providing space for exhibitions and public access. But I guess I'm just wondering that if somebody who's in a correctional facility wants, are there opportunities for art, for somebody to be involved in the arts beyond art from the inside? I mean, are there resources? Because I guess I would hope that just more generally that would be there. But yeah, if you can shed some light on that.
Mr. Espinoza.
Thank you for that question. Stillwater has an art class, and I believe there's another facility that has another art class, St. Cloud. And not all the art that's created is in people's cells in the common areas. So I do believe that art, and not only just visual art, but, you know, dance and music and writing books and poetry, is a way of calming people down and showing their skills and still doing something productive while they're in prison. And, you know, we need to uplift people so that it could be better. Because once they're better, we all are better. And so we can't give up on people, and I'm not going to give up on the incarcerated, and I'm not going to give up on the people I worked with as guards. You know, the system, I'm not going to go against the system. I want to help them. I want to help all of us to be safer in our communities.
Right. Actually, we need to move on because we do have another bill. So we're going to move on to closing comments, Representative Henningsen Yeager.
I really don't need to say much. I think the work being done, you know, I will direct your attention to the letter from Ms. Liz Beckel, a clinical program therapist in the correctional facility at Faribault, to talk about the more therapy aspects of it. You know, when we talk about humans and self-worth and self-esteem, like, those lead to positive outcomes. So I will continue to work closely with Mr. Espinoza and the DOC as this continues to move, and I would just really appreciate your thoughtful consideration and your inclusion into your omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I renew my motion and lay over House File 2167 as amended. Thank you again for being here today. We very much appreciate your testimony and the work you do. Next on the agenda, members, we have House File 2282. It's a Representative Finke bill. We'll be laying this bill over. I will move to lay over House File 2282. There are no amendments, so we can get right into the bill discussion. Welcome to the committee, Representative Finke, and please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mohler and members. I'm very happy to be here today to present Home for Good. And yeah, I know that we are pressed for time, so we'll just go ahead and get started. House File 2282 is a bill that would appropriate $7.5 million next year, 24 and 25, to the Department of Corrections to expand the work release program in a manner consistent with public safety and inmate rehabilitation. I will reserve the rest of my remarks for closing and pass it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. Great. And I'm not sure what order you want to go in, so I'm just going to let you introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome to all of you to the committee, and sorry we're running late, so thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. My name is Terrell Shaw. I just served 22 years in prison. Actually, I know Espinoza when he was an officer. I also work with IWOC, and the reason why we're here today is because you guys are all talking about me and my life. How do you fix me? How do you solve me? Well, I'm going to tell you how you do it. You're going to have to expand work release. Every problem that I've faced since I've been out of prison has not been because, oh, I want to go commit crimes. It's because I can't have housing. It's been very difficult to get housing. It took me 5 months just to get eligibility for housing. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. It's hard to get jobs. And then when you get jobs, it's always low pay. So you're just working just to, struggle to pay your bills. And then you look at us and say, oh, you guys are ministers of society. That's not the case. We're just not given the same opportunities as everybody else. Because in prison, those nightmarish events that Paul Schnell described, I lived those. My friends were the ones dying because of drug overdoses and committing suicides because they're locked in their cells 2 to 3 weeks without showers, inadequate food. This is what's going on inside of prison. People are miserable. That's why guards don't stay, because they have to watch this misery, and live in this misery right along with us. So we're kind of in the same boat in a sense. So if you guys really want to fix this problem, expand work release. And don't just make it something that the commissioner has something he can do. Make him do it. Because when I was in prison, the only light was college. That's why I'm here today, speaking to you. And then when I got out, there was no help from the DOC. No, it really wasn't. I was kicked out of my home that I paid rent with, because the reentry program that we were in, some contract fell between Hennepin County and the reentry program. I got a call. You got to leave within 24 hours. Do you know what that means usually? That means you're going back to prison because you have no housing. So I'm homeless. Not because of something I did, because of a mistake made by the DOC here in the county or whoever, and the reentry program. This is a problem that you guys got to fix. because the nightmarish conditions that's being created in prison, the 90% of people who's getting out, yeah, those, they might be us, but they won't be standing here looking like me. They'll be out there struggling, trying to survive. So I'm just keeping it real with y'all. It's a sad condition. The DOC is asking for $200 million on top of what they're already getting. How much is going to work with these? $15 million? Shouldn't it be like 40%? I mean, you guys are crying about safety and crime and all of this. Safety and crime is stopped when people have opportunities and they take advantage of those opportunities. If you present them, people will take them. I did. I got 2 degrees in prison. And then I finished. I struggled when I got out, not knowing, am I going to be homeless tomorrow? Am I going to have a job tomorrow? But I got to stay focused, because if I don't, I'm going right back into that nightmare that this system created. And then you're probably going to blame me for something that I had no control over. Really? So I just ask y'all to just take a look at that and just open your hearts. Because we don't talk about humanity and healing that much. We talk about security and how we keep a tight grip on these guys. That's not right, man. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. And I'm so sorry, we're running really late and we need to be out of this room very soon. So if the other two can keep your testimony brief, I want to have a chance for members to ask questions. Go ahead.
Absolutely, and if you want to give me 1 minute notice, that's fine, 30 seconds
or so. Okay, great. If you can move the mic closer to you too, please. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Thank you all for being here. I know we've been here a long time, but this is something that's very important. We need to get people home for good. We need to put people to work. People need those things in their life. It is crazy to spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on putting someone in a cage and have them come out with $100 at a homeless shelter. Are you serious? Is this what we're doing here? Is this how we're creating safety in this state? Don't do that, okay? Work release guarantees people housing while they can find a job. It guarantees people housing while they get work experience so they can keep a job. It gives them housing while they get transportation, okay? If you want people to succeed, you have to set them up and you have to scaffold it. This is what work release does. It's also cheaper than prison. So we should be doing something, and if we're going the way we need to be saving money and creating more safety. That's really important, and we can do both of those things together, okay? Another thing, we talked about prison short staffing. We talked about a man being murdered in prison. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say a few more things here. If we don't get staffing under control, which means getting prison population under control, we're going to spend $200 million and be back here in 2 years with more of the same problem. So there's a lot of good investments in that budget, but if we're not going to address the problem of population in our prisons, we are putting the buck down the road, and this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to make significant change. So if we are not going to invest in a different path, which means prison is for people who are dangerous and not for people who are not, and shrinking the system and investing in shrinking this system so that we can actually support the people there and we can actually have resources in our community to succeed. If we don't do this, we're going to come back in 2 years and they're going to ask you to build a prison or two prisons. This is not the solution and this is not the time to do this. Also, sorry, quick things. If we want the MRA to succeed, which is a beautiful vision that we need, people need to have a chance to earn success. Work release is also an earned program. We need to make sure we stick the reentry, okay? And so we have to make sure we invest in reentry, which the MRA does not do. So that's my main points. Please, this is really important that we do this. It's really important that we set a different path, which means getting technical violators, people who qualify for work release, people who are nonviolent. These people should not be in our prisons, and we need to invest in doing that instead of investing in the status quo that keeps us in the same place. I'm sorry.
And can you just state your name for the record, too?
Thank you. Yeah, David Benke. I've been working with people in prison on a daily basis for the last 8 years. Thank you so much.
Okay, and our final testifier, welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Chair, Committee. My name is Tamara Hill. I'm here to testify on two capacities today, which is one as a registered lobbyist and policy officer at the Center for Victims of Torture. I've been in front of your committee before, so I'll skip the long intro. If you have questions about the org, just let me know. And also in a personal capacity as someone who's been directly affected by having family and incarceration. On the CVT side, we've been working on expanding work release with our community members for almost the past year. We know that the ability to work and the right to work is heavily connected to being able to thrive not only economically, but also mentally and emotionally. It reunites families and communities, and we're really invested in seeing work release expanded in our state. On the personal side, I usually don't share too much about me personally, but felt really called to do it today. My father was incarcerated when I was 4, and he was a stranger to me until I was a teenager, because he was in prison for almost my entire childhood. When I was about 13, I met a man who I only had one memory of, which was being arrested.
I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you, but there's audience talking and I can't hear you. I'm sorry, go ahead, please continue.
It's okay. I met a man when I was 13 that the only memory I had of was being arrested in front of me when I was 4 while I sat in PJs on the floor. And because of that, I grew up in abject poverty. I grew up in a single family household. Between the ages of 16 to the time I finished my master's degree, I worked between 30 to 55 hours to put myself through 2 degrees, help my mom pay rent, and afford groceries for me and my younger brother. And investment in reentry, like work release, could have significantly changed the life that I led. It could have allowed me to know my father sooner and also decreased the economic burden that was put on me as a literal child to help take care of my family. So thank you all so much for the ability to testify today. I hope you strongly consider work release and not just the impact it has on people who are incarcerated, but on the families and the generational poverty that can help alleviate. Thank you.
Thank you so much to all of you for your testimony. We're going to move on to member questions. Representative Gin.
Thanks, Chair Mueller. And that was really compelling testimony. I'm going to be 100% honest. That was really, really compelling. And I want to know how many folks aren't able to pursue these opportunities because they don't know that it exists for them. And I also want to know who is applicable. You know, the DOC, I know that they list the qualifications to some extent, but we do want to make sure that the public safety and the public good, the interest of, violence in our communities, that that's prevented. But we also want those opportunities to be there because if they're not, you're kind of left with nothing at the end of the day when you get out. How can we ensure both things happen at once? And I guess I'm just curious, Representative Finke, maybe you know this, what the DOC qualifications currently are.
Representative Finke.
I think I'd pass this over to my testifier.
Yep, Mr. Finke.
Yeah, so...
if you can move the mic, too.
There's currently 1,400 people who qualify under state statute for this, who are assessed as low risk by the DOC, who are currently being denied access to this. So that's the today number, if that makes sense. The qualifications under state law are twofold. One is you have to have served half your term of imprisonment, and two, you have to be... It has to be in the public interest and public safety to release you. So again, it is an earned program, and you have to have shown that you will be safe for the public to access the program.
Representative Gin.
Just one quick follow-up, and these aren't gotcha questions, I promise. Does this include violent offenders?
Absolutely. Someone should not be judged by one bad day of their life. And if you look at the risk assessments across the DOC, you have people who are very low risk to commit a new crime who have committed a violent crime. So, yes, this includes all sorts of people, and everyone needs to have a chance at redemption and to be able to say, hey, I will have a chance in my life to earn something.
Representing again.
Thank you. And I think that's where we're just going to have to agree to disagree to some extent. That's just where I'm coming from. I don't want that to pose a threat to somebody else and potentially create a new victim. We should still have opportunities for those folks, but maybe just not in the same scope as somebody who is a nonviolent offender.
Hang on a second. I'm going to call on Representative Finke.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. And Representative, for your question, I would just say that currently this program does include all eligible members, regardless of the crime that they may or may have committed, to receive their sentence. But according to the Department of Corrections, people who are part of the work release program, fewer than 2% will go on to commit new crimes. They're at very low risk of reoffending.
Sorry, it's actually, it's 0.2 when on work release.
Oh, go ahead, Mr. Bank.
0.2.
It's 0.2%. It's less than 0.2%. It's less than 1 in 500 commit a crime, new felony crime on work release, so you don't.
Yeah.
Thank you for that correction.
Yeah, thanks for that correction. Okay, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, you had mentioned that there's folks who are eligible who are denied, I assume, based on lack of resources. How much of, what percentage of those folks will be serviced by this appropriation? I'm trying to get an idea of where you're at.
Mr. Binky?
Yeah, sorry, I'm the numbers person. So if you want to say something else, please do. But the per diem for work release is $90 a day. And so if we're talking about 7.5 million, we're talking about 200 some people. If they're doing it for the whole year, if they're doing it for 6 months, then it's double. So we're talking somewhere between 400 and 1,000 people in this two-year allocation. And again, work release is cheaper than prison. So if we're investing wisely and we're planning ahead, we should actually be using this to reduce the prison population and save money on the back end. So if you want to also save money and shift money on the front end, we're open to that concept, but that's not the current bill language.
Representative Navani, no? All right. Thank you so much for all of you for being here. Representative, oh, I see Chair Beckerfin. Sorry, I couldn't see you behind our researcher there. Go ahead.
thank you, Chair Mueller. And two things I just wanted to touch on. You know, I think whether it's popular culture or things we read on the internet, sort of our idea of what somebody who's incarcerated for a violent crime, what that means, you know, it could be a domestic violence incident. It could be things that are often relational and situational. And I think, you know, thinking about people as people first is really helpful. And I know that the Department of Corrections, I mean, they use evidence-based tools to assess risk as they're deciding who's eligible for this program. So I think that that's really important to note as we talk about who's eligible and who's not. I also encourage members of this committee, if you have not, to really have some deeper conversations with people who have been incarcerated and what it does to the culture of the entire population when these opportunities exist versus when they don't. If there's a reason to spend your time incarcerated working towards these things versus spending your time, you know, ticking the calendar till you go back to whatever you know, because that's all you know. It really is crime prevention in the future. And then finally, I just wanted to thank the last testifier for lifting up the impact that this has on the families of people who are incarcerated and the long-term benefit and harm prevention that there is in families being more connected with their loved one, because we know if we can reduce the ACEs factor, if we can reduce that for our young people moving forward, that's also going to reduce the risk that they are going to commit crimes as adults. And so I just thought that was really important that that part of it is lifted up. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Pinky.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you to everyone for your patience, and to whoever's using this room next. Sorry, this is an urgent issue, though. I share the urgency of what we're talking about. This is a way that we can help people avoid homelessness. We can help people find jobs. We can help with the crisis that we're seeing in the job, the worker shortage, both outside of our prisons, but inside of our prisons. This will benefit corrections officers. It will benefit up and down. It's a program that works. Department of Corrections knows that it works. We need to fund it, and we need to get people who do not need to be living in prisons out of prisons. That is a moral obligation we have to follow up on, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, and thanks again for everybody for being here today. I renew my motion and lay over House File 2282, and I do have an announcement before we adjourn here. Next week, we have a full week of extra hearings and many bills, apologizing in advance. Public testimony will be taken based only on advanced sign-up with our CA, Ellen McDaniel, and may also be limited. So please watch any online postings for bills. We are hearing and connect with Ms. McDaniel. As always, we welcome written testimony that we will produce for members and also post online. With that, thanks again, everybody. We are adjourned.